Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Most of us have probably heard about the Fugitive Slave Act when we were in school. But many of us, and I mean people kind of like me, probably hardly remember anything from school at all. So I became personally reacquainted with this notorious law from 1850, about 15 years ago when I was a Capitol Hill correspondent. And the House of Representatives, which I was covering, was debating this draconian immigration proposal in an attempt of broader immigration reform. And suddenly, as I'm watching the House floor, one member after another from the Congressional Black Caucus took to the floor, lambasting Republican authors of this bill, accusing them of trying to bring back this Fugitive Slave Act. And what they were talking about was this provision in which proposed to allow bounty hunters to capture undocumented immigrants in order to be deported. Now, that proposal never did become law, but it certainly left a mark on me. It was this powerful moment to watch, to see one black lawmaker after another speaking passionately about this tragic past and how they were fearful it was about to be repeated. The debate and the effect of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, in some ways, I feel, is kind of like the debate over building a wall in the U.S.-Mexican border. Now, I'm not saying it's the same thing. I'm not saying it's slavery, but both polarized society at the time, and both would bring government to a halt. The Fugitive Slave Act was seen as a precursor to the Civil War, and, well, the border wall has brought this government shutdown. So today we are going to be in conversation about the history of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. My guest is Andrew DelBanco. Andrew DelBanco is the Alexander Hamilton Professor of American Studies at Columbia University, and he is the author of the book, The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul, from the Revolution to the Civil War. Andrew DelBanco, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And I try to be careful. We think history is important on this radio program. We talk a lot about history. Of course, the present moment comes from the past. But I did feel at liberty a bit to lay out what I just did, largely after reading the introduction of your book. And I want to quote a part that I found very powerful, and that is this, quote, "There is an aphorism attributed to Mark Twain, though no evidence exists that he ever said it, that while history does not repeat itself, it does rhyme. The Fugitive Slave story is a rhyming story. It is possible to follow it without hearing echoes in our own time. It is about the breakup of two major political parties in antebellum America. It is about the rise of what might be called the first Black Lives Matter movement, as black people in the North protested the outrage of slavery and stormed the jails where runaway slaves were held. It is about the establishment of sanctuary cities where fugitives, the undocumented immigrants of their time, sought safe haven." I was very much, and it made me think of that moment 15 years ago for me when I was on Capitol Hill, very struck by that moment when I read that undocumented immigrants of today were the fugitives of the past.
Everybody has a different way of writing books, but I follow the practice of writing the introduction last, at the end of the reading and thinking and writing process. So what you just read comes from the section of the book that I wrote most recently. Why I say that is because this is a book that occupied me for many years. So when I undertook it, although the issue of immigration was already part of our political discourse, as you say, your memory goes back 15 years on that point, I didn't have any explicit intention of telling a story that had a particular parallel or congruity with the events of our own time. But I did feel, by the time I got to the end of the book, that there were some uncomfortable echoes. There were positions being staked out 150 plus years ago that feel uncomfortably familiar. And I guess one of the conclusions I drew from writing the book is that many of the conflicts within the United States that were worked out in the last, well, two centuries ago now, are still with us in one form or another. So, yes, the parallels are there. I think responsible historians have to be wary about making exact parallels, but I'm happy to talk about both past and present in this conversation.
Let's dive into this story. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, exactly what did it do?
Well, in order to say that in a coherent way, I think I have to go back in time, if that's okay, to the founding of the Republic itself. We all remember learning in school that in 1787, delegates from 13 former British colonies, actually it was 12 because the delegates from Rhode Island didn't show up, came to Philadelphia with the aim in mind of creating a unified nation that would be more coherent than the nation that had existed under the Articles of Confederation from the early 1780s. And the sort of starting point of this story, in my view, is that those representatives knew they were coming from really two separate countries. Slavery was a reality of the moment. And so if they were going to put these two countries, as I'm calling them, together into one country, they had to make some compromises. They had to make some accommodations with one another. They did that in a number of different ways. But the one that's central to the story in my book was what we have now come to call the Fugitive Slave Clause, which I don't have in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase it. It basically stated that no person owing service or labor in one state could escape that obligation by going physically to another state, but must be returned to the party to whom service or labor is due. Now, this was essentially what I like to call a kind of intranational extradition treaty. It was the statement in principle that if a human being owned under the laws of Alabama or North Carolina or Virginia fled in search of freedom to Connecticut or New York or Massachusetts, that person would have to be returned to the party owning him or her under the laws of the state of origin. The key thing to note about that clause is that it's very, very vague. It's cast in a passive language, and it makes no attempt to specify how this is going to be enforced.
And this is Article 4, Section 2, if I recall correctly, of the Constitution.
Correct. And it's still in the Constitution. It was never formally repealed, though we can sort of get away with that because the word slave or slavery is never mentioned in that clause, as indeed the words are never mentioned in the Constitution. And we can talk, if you like, a little bit about why that might be the case. But there are several places in the Constitution that are clearly referring to slavery. This is one of them. Now, one reason it's still in there is because it has a broader application. It referred also to white indentured servants. It referred to persons convicted of crime in one state who might flee to another state. So it has certain, as I say, broader applications, but it was understood from the first as applying primarily and forcefully to the issue of human slavery. What it didn't say was who was going to enforce this principle. Was the fugitive going to be captured and returned by the local police department they didn't have formal police departments, but by the local law officers in, say, Watertown, Massachusetts, or by the state government of Connecticut, or by the federal government itself, which we want to remember in the early years of the Republic was very weak and had very little ability to enforce its own dictates. So it was left vague. It's as if the founding fathers were sort of punting the problem, making a formal gesture at the problem and hoping that one way or another it would go away. Well, as we know, it didn't go away. Not only was Jefferson wrong about his expectation that slavery would expire, he was dead wrong about it. Slavery became more and more central to the life of the South, and indeed to the economy of the whole nation, with the rise of certain technologies that made the production of crops like cotton and sugar more efficient and more profitable. The population of enslaved persons in the South grew rapidly, and it became less and less conceivable that slavery could be gradually eased out of existence, and more clear that there was a fundamental conflict between the slave society of the South and the putatively free society of the North.
Why was it worded the way it was, and to have the effect that it was largely unenforceable?
Well, I think that was, this is a misleading way to put it, perhaps, because there was nothing good about the Fugitive Slave Clause from our point of view, or from the point of view of many who signed on to it. But you could say it was the best they could do. They needed to put this principle in the Constitution. Many commentators then and since have said, without it, there would have been no Constitution. That is, without some accommodation between these two different societies, there was no incentive for the slave owners to sign on to this project of creating a union. So they sort of, put this in a vague way, as one can imagine we might do in a negotiation, to try to get past the problem and get on to the what they regard as the more important business of putting this country together. And then, as I said, they hoped that the problem would somehow take care of itself. It didn't. I mentioned one reason why it didn't already. Another reason is because in the first half of the 19th century, the nation expanded vastly and rapidly westward. So the border between the slave states and the free states got longer and longer and more porous. And the fundamental fact of life, which slave owners knew just as well as non-slave owners, namely that human beings do not wish to be enslaved, that fact continued to drive thousands of enslaved persons to risk their lives and risk the little that they had to seek freedom either in the North or in some cases outside the Union altogether in British Canada. And that the problem became a more and more difficult political problem, legal problem, and most important, human problem, which is what I try to put at the center of the story as I tell it.
The expansion of the United States is an important story, and even understanding the Civil War, and we really start here with the Mexican-American War. Why was that so important?
To put it bluntly, the United States went to war against Mexico in 1846 to wage a war of conquest. It was a largely unprovoked war, and it resulted in the acquisition of a vast amount of new territory, including the new state of California and many future states, Nevada, Arizona, Utah. It added to the United States a tract of territory that is equivalent to roughly 30% of our present day nation. And so the acquisition of so much territory greeted triumphantly, certainly in the South and to some extent in the North as well, turned out to create or to recreate or reignite the sectional tension, the conflict that had been latent from the very beginning of the Republic, because it raised the question of whether slavery would be legal, whether it would be tolerated in these new territories. From the point of view of slave owners, the right to take their human property into the federal territories was a fundamental constitutional right. Hard as it may be for us to fathom, they regarded human beings as a species of property. They regarded the whole point of the Constitution as to institute property protections to protect them from the arbitrary tyrannical rule of the King of England, who had been deposed by the Revolution. And so from their point of view, the idea that this central government could tell them where they could take their property was totally outrageous. And from a practical point of view, the ability to expand slavery was essential to its survival, because the soil would be depleted and exhausted after a certain number of harvest seasons. And in order to stay in business, which is the case today for many business enterprises, if not all, in order to stay in business, you had to expand. To stay still or to contract was to eventually disappear. So from a Southern point of view, that right to take slaves into the territories was a cardinal right. From the point of view of many people in the North, the federal government had every right to regulate the institutions of the territories. It had no right to interfere, and this was stipulated pretty clearly in the Constitution. It had no right to interfere with the institutions of the individual states. But the territories, including those acquired from Mexico, were a different story. And for a whole variety of reasons, ranging from moral outrage on the part of certain principled abolitionists to racism, which is to say many white people in the North who didn't like slavery didn't like it because they didn't like black people. They didn't want to have black people in their neighborhood. If they had, say, staked out land claim out west, they didn't want to have to compete with slave labor brought into the neighborhood by Southern slave owners. Recent immigrants in the North, industrial workers in the North, were hostile to slavery. Again, not necessarily because they were concerned with the rights and circumstances of black people, but because they didn't want to deal with the competition. So anti-slavery is a complicated phenomenon, and we could talk about that if you like. But for a variety of reasons, this conflict began to focus on the destiny of the territories. And out of that conflict, which came out of the Mexican War, came the notorious Compromise of 1850. And now we finally arrived in this conversation at the Fugitive Slave Law, which was very much at the heart of that compromise.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Andrew Delbanco. He is the Alexander Hamilton Professor of American Studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves, and The Struggle for America's Soul, From the Revolution to the Civil War. And we are in conversation about the history of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. So my understanding of the Fugitive Slave Act, then, Professor, is that it is to give what's already in the Constitution some teeth. How does it do that?
Exactly right. That's a good way to put it. It tried to put teeth into the toothless clause of the Constitution. And it was a merciless law. It stipulated that the accused fugitive had no right, the most fundamental right in the Anglo-American legal tradition, that is the right of habeas corpus, the right to contest one's detention in open court. It stipulated that the defendant had no right to a jury trial, no right to testify in his or her own defense. It made it a federal crime for a citizen of a northern state to aid or harbor such a fugitive. It required citizens to come to the aid of legal authorities in capturing and returning such a fugitive. It didn't quite create, but it enlarged a whole category of federal officials called commissioners who had the right through this law to hold a hearing. It could be a justice of the peace or a local sheriff or some other appointed official, hold a hearing, consider the documentary evidence presented by the plaintiff or the agent of the slave owner who had come north to hunt down a suspected fugitive, make a decision unilaterally without any court procedure, anything resembling due process, on whether that person did indeed belong under the laws of the state of residence of the plaintiff to the plaintiff, and if so, order that person sent back to slavery. So it was a law that outraged a great many people it was, if there was ever, I might put it this way, if there was ever a law of unintended consequences, this was it, because the intention was to hold the country together. The intention was to seal this deal, this compromise that had a number of other elements, like California would come in as a free state, the fate of slavery would be decided later on in some of the other territories acquired from Mexico. In the District of Columbia, they tried to split it, make a deal by sustaining the legality of slavery itself, but abolishing the legality of the slave trade, so you could no longer buy and sell human beings within earshot of the United States Capitol, which was going on until that time. So they had a number of different elements, but the Fugitive Slave Law, which was demanded by a number of Southern senators and representatives, was the linchpin that was intended to hold this thing together. Instead, it had the opposite effect, and that's a large part of the story I try to tell.
People in the North at this time then, in the 1850s and post the Fugitive Slave Act, they weren't unfamiliar with seeing slaves, because people from the South would visit the North and oftentimes they would be accompanied by slaves. But nonetheless, this Fugitive Slave Act law that were forcing people, actually making it, I guess, illegal not to try to return a slave to a slave owner in the South. This, in a very real way, made it real for people in the North.
I think that's right. And, you know, I spoke earlier about the United States, the putatively unified nation, as being really two nations. And I think that's a fair statement. But at the same time, it's quite clear in retrospect, and it should have been clear at the time, that Northerners were up to their eyeballs in slavery from the beginning. The banks of State Street in Boston and Wall Street in New York City were financing the plantations. The textile mills that came to Massachusetts in the 1820s and 30s and were the vanguard of the Industrial Revolution were spinning slave-grown cotton into cloth for domestic consumption or for the export trade. Indeed, everybody who walked down the street wearing cotton clothing was wearing the blood, sweat, and tears of slaves on their back. So it's not as if the law of 1850 suddenly made the North involved in slavery. But it made slavery, I think, visible and palpable in a new way. A figure like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was arguably the leading intellectual of the North, who had been relatively marginal to the anti-slavery movement until then. I mean, he didn't like slavery. He spoke out against it to some extent. But he was pretty uninvolved in the movement. Suddenly woke up to realize that there was slavery in Massachusetts. And Emerson put it, I think, quite vividly when he said in a talk after the passage of the law, "No one tasted blood in the treats," by which he meant when we put sugar in our tea or enjoyed our pie and cake, no one realized or thought about the fact that we were enjoying it at the expense of enslaved human beings who were providing the sweetness of the treats.
Almost like today when we look at our iPhones or smartphones.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I'm glad you said that, because one thing I had in mind in writing this book, I mean, I think I would like to think that very few people in our country, either privately or publicly, would dare to say anything in defense of the institution of slavery. The evil of slavery is not, in my mind anyway, a debatable proposition. But that's not quite the same thing as saying that I'm comfortable with standing in judgment on these people from the past who failed to see as clearly as we think we see the evil that was before their eyes. Before we go out on that limb and condemn our forebears, we ought to ask ourselves the question, I think, how honest and scrupulous are we in thinking about where the pleasures and conveniences that we enjoy come from? how much do we want to know about where that $6 t-shirt that we bought in the big box store came from, and who was involved in producing it? So I'm only saying that because on the one hand, I want to acknowledge this kind of widespread hypocrisy, we could call it, or willed moral myopia, perhaps we could call it. On the other hand,
it also makes Ralph Emerson's quote there real.
That's right. It makes it real for it. And, you know, we started out this conversation with the connections between past and present. I'm telling a story in this book, which is about the past. It's about an institution that no longer exists, thank God, in our country, though it's not as if its legacies have been expunged. So it's about the past. But I don't think anybody can write or should really even be interested in reading about the past without some feeling of human connectedness between their experience and our experience. So I tried to sustain that feeling throughout the narrative. In any event, the Fugitive Slave Law changed all that. It made it much harder for Northerners to pretend that slavery was somebody else's problem. Because suddenly, your neighbor, someone, you know, who you may have seen around town for years or months, was being pursued down the street before your eyes by a legally constituted band of thugs, really a mob, a legal mob, put in chains, taken to the jailhouse, sent back without anything resembling due process, put on a ship, let's say in Boston Harbor, which happened several times in the early 1850s, and sent back to a very angry slave master in Savannah, Georgia, or Newport News, Virginia, or wherever. It became much harder under those circumstances to pretend that slavery was somebody else's problem. And in that sense, I mean, one of the paradoxes of the story was captured by the most famous fugitive slave of them all, Frederick Douglass, who said that the Fugitive Slave Law did great service to the anti-slavery movement. It was a gift to the movement, because although it brought misery and pain to quite a number of individuals, and that's not a trivial although, for the larger movement, it inspired a new sense of immediacy and outrage among Northerners. One good example that comes to mind, a man named Amos Lawrence, who was one of the big textile magnates of New England, who had been very quiet about slavery until then, knowing full well that his business depended on the exported cotton from the South. When a slave named Anthony Burns was chased down the streets of Boston and sent back by ship to his slave owner, Amos Lawrence wrote, "We went to bed as good compromise unionists. We woke up as stark, mad abolitionists." It changed his mind. And in fact, he went on to finance the anti-slavery forces in Kansas, Nebraska. And there's a city in Kansas called Lawrence, Kansas, named after him, which was the bastion of freedom when the conflict over slavery shifted to that part of the country. So the Fugitive Slave Law had an important effect on the way in which Americans aligned on the issue.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize Lawrence was named after him in Kansas. And Lawrence was sort of the center of the resistance during the abolitionists during really guerrilla warfare that was occurring in the 1850s Kansas. We may get to that, but I want to ask you this. We've done shows before on what they call Bleeding Kansas. I want to ask you, when you say that there, at this period of time, in the 1850s, an establishment of sanctuary cities where fugitives sought safe haven. Now, sanctuary cities are in quotation marks, so maybe they didn't call them sanctuary cities, but what does that mean?
Well, I mean, it became a point of pride for many Bostonians, not all. I mean, Boston became an ideologically divided city with bitter disputes between even members of the same family. But it did become a point of pride for a great many people in Boston that this was a place where fugitives would not be hunted down. And after couple of successful fugitive renditions, Bostonians became determined never to allow it to happen again. And I think it's fair to say that Southern slave owners decided it really wasn't worth the trouble and the expense to pursue a fugitive who had made it to Boston, because there was very likely to be resistance. There was something called a vigilance committee that popped up in many cities throughout the North in the 1840s and 50s. And that, you know, once your human property got as far as Boston, well, you know, might as well give up on the chase. Boston wasn't the only place where that was true. Rochester, New York, which was the headquarters for Frederick Douglass, even cities closer to the southern border, such as Cincinnati, saw a resistance movement and elements of what we now call the Underground Railroad, where people would take a risk by protecting and harboring, sheltering, hiding fugitive slaves. So there was a movement, not an organized movement, but a sort of spontaneous movement, which became, among other things, biracial. I mean, this was arguably the first instance where black people and white people really joined forces and worked together in the cause of resistance in the North, and in that sense foreshadowed some of the developments of the 20th century. What, if I could add one more note to this part of the discussion, I mean, one of the interesting features of the period I was writing about, one of the ways in which it feels to me it connects to our own moment, is that if you think about the slogan states' rights, we tend quite rightly to associate that slogan with the conservative right, and in particular with Southern conservatives animated by racial prejudice. So I'm old enough to remember Governor George Wallace of Alabama standing in the schoolhouse door and saying, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, in response to the Supreme Court decision of 1954 and the efforts by the federal government to enforce it. In other words, federal government, stay out of our business. Alabamians have the right to construct their own lives the way they want to. That is, white Alabamians. Now, the godfather of states' rights, the theorist of states' rights, was John C. Calhoun, senator from South Carolina, who lived until just barely into 1850, so isn't really part of the story, but he built up the theory of states' rights. What happened in 1850...
And he was a great defender of slavery up until that point.
He was indeed. Yeah. He wasn't. So what happened in 1850 is that suddenly states' rights became the mantra of Northern liberals. People in Massachusetts were suddenly saying, hey, to the federal government, stay out of our business. You have no right to send federal officers to Boston, Massachusetts, and tell us what the rights of our neighbors are. You know, this is Boston, the home of the American Revolution. Stay out of our lives. And Southerners, Southern slave owners, became the big proponents of federal power, big fans of the federal government, urging the federal government to send thousands of troops to the cities of New England. In one case, one Georgia newspaper says, let's send the artillery up there and level Boston to the ground to show them that they can't resist the law of the land. So the right and the left switched places in the 1850s, much as they are doing in some respects right now, where progressives are saying it's up to the states, the state of California, the state of New York, to resist the efforts by the federal government to hunt down undocumented immigrants who may be our neighbors, may have been working in our restaurants or farms for years and years, and that the state will not cooperate with federal authorities in this matter. So, you know, I just take note of that as a way to suggest maybe that's one of the rhymes that the story I tell in this book sounds in my ear as we think about the present day.
I can't also help but think about how important maybe this issue and just the symbol of the wall is right now.
Well, indeed. I mean, what this dispute really came down to is that Southern slave owners were saying to Northerners, we want border security to use the phrase that we hear now every hour on the hour. We want border security. Now, they didn't talk about erecting a literal wall, although recently I encountered a constituent of John Quincy Adams in the 1830s saying we should build a wall between the North and the South. Now, he didn't mean to keep fugitives from running away. He meant just to make it clear that we are two different countries and we don't want to have anything to do with them. But in any case, yes, the question of policing the border was at the core of this dispute. And you might say, I mean, that it was at least as futile to imagine any kind of simple or consensual way in which the border could be closed between North and South as it is today, to imagine that our southern border could be completely sealed against desperate human beings fleeing desperate conditions. They are not going to stop trying to come. And, Lincoln says somewhere, people seldom run unless they have something to run from. Well, the reality that human beings fled slavery was a daily confirmation of that truth.
Quick time out here, Professor, because we are at the top of the hour. I would like to go an additional 10 minutes. Are you okay with that? I want to respect your time.
That's fine.
Okay. Here, Andrew Delbenko is our guest. Andrew Delbenko is the Alexander Hamilton Professor of American Studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including the one that we are in conversation about. It's called The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to the Civil War. Andrew Delbenko, when you say also that there were black people in the North, as they were protesting the outrage of slavery, also stormed the jails where runaway slaves were being held. Tell me about that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one instance where a runaway slave named Joshua Glover, and I'm blanking right now whether this happened in Wisconsin or where exactly, forgive me, but a group of local black residents got their hands on a big piece of wood, which they used as a ramrod, a battering ram, knocked down the jailhouse door. And one of the witnesses wrote about it later, boom, 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 and out came Glover. In Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania, a slave owner showed up at a farmhouse to try to recapture two slaves who had run from his service. And a leader of what you might call a local black militia confronted him, warned him to leave, told him they were not going to allow this to happen. And when the slave owner didn't back down, shots were fired, and one of the slave owner's own sons actually lay dead. In Boston, a slave named Shadrach Minkins was rescued from the courtroom while a hearing was underway, when a group of black Bostonians burst into the courtroom, seized him, rushed him out the door, and whisked him away through what we might call underground railroad stations until he managed to find security in Montreal, Canada. So black people did take matters into their own hands. This was outrageous to many Americans, white Americans, not just in the South, but particularly in the South. It looked like the specter of anarchy. It looked like the racial hierarchy, which a great many Americans regarded as written in nature itself, was being turned upside down. And it threw the whole country into turmoil. And I want to say that part of the story, which is one that some readers will find congenial and others will not, is that some white people of good conscience who deplored slavery, but who also believed that the law had to be respected, whether we liked the law or not, didn't know what to do under these circumstances. They didn't know how to think about this problem. And I don't think it's an easy problem for us any more than it was for them. When a duly constituted law appears to be in conflict with justice. The fact is, the fugitive slave rendition requirement was written into the United States Constitution. Every duly seated federal judge, indeed every judge, had sworn fidelity to the United States Constitution. So what do you do when Congress passes a law that appears to be consistent with the Constitution, and yet personally you find it repulsive? What do you do? And the answer to that question is complicated and various. Different judges and different police officials, different ministers and clergy responded to that question in different ways. And that, too, is part of the story that I try to tell.
While you're talking there, Joshua Glover, the first story you told of trying to break somebody, a fugitive slave, out of jail, that was in Wisconsin. It was in the jail was in Milwaukee.
Right.
So just to clarify, I looked it up while you were talking. I didn't know that off the top of my head. That's interesting that you lay that out, because when we talk about the Civil War, we talk about it today, and there's always this argument, was it about slavery? Was it about state rights? And I think most people today agree it was about slavery. And I think if you study the Civil War for the South, it was certainly about slavery. But you might be able to make an argument it would become about slavery for the North, but it wasn't always so clear if that's what it was really about for the North, especially at the beginning of the war.
Absolutely right. I mean, the war began when the forces of the state of South Carolina, which had declared itself an independent nation, in effect, fired on a federal installation in Charleston Harbor. The war began in earnest when President Lincoln called up 75,000 volunteers to put down what he called a domestic insurrection. And we all know more or less how it went from there. Everybody expected it to be a short war, which is the way most people seem to feel about all wars when they start. Remember how Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld told us that the problem in Iraq would be solved in a couple of weeks and we'd be greeted as liberators. But we know in reality the war went on for 4 years and an unfathomable number of people died in it. The historians keep raising the estimates. The most recent I've seen are starting to approach 1 million killed. That's not to mention the millions more who were mutilated either psychologically or physically. By far the most costly war in blood of any in our history. If you extrapolate the number of 1 million in a nation of roughly 30 million, you can do the math and figure out what that would mean in our own nation today, tens of millions. So as that war wore on, it evolved from a war whose first explicit, you know, war aim on the part of the North was to preserve the Union. The South was very frank about their reasons. Their reasons were to ensure that they could make real the secession that they had announced. And they were quite explicit, actually, that they were seceding because they were defending the institution of slavery. There's no beating around that bush. To pretend otherwise is just not to read the texts from the time. But in the North, it was more ambiguous. There were a lot of Northerners who were, as I said earlier, relatively neutral about slavery, not morally that agitated about it, who did feel that it was important to preserve the Union and to put down this insurrection. So the war began as a war for union, but as it went on, it became, I think it feels to us in retrospect, inevitably a war against slavery. Why do I say that? Because for one thing, as the Union Army penetrated more deeply into what became Confederate territory, hundreds of thousands of enslaved persons became fugitives. And the forces of the Union, the generals on the battlefield and the officials back in Washington, had to confront this totally new set of circumstances. What do we do with these people? Do we corral them and sustain them in detention camps and then give them back to their masters after this quarrel is settled? That became an unthinkable proposition, as both for moral reasons. I mean, a lot of people began to say and to see that the idea of returning human beings to slavery who had been, for all practical purposes, emancipated by the army itself was unthinkable. So as the war went on, it became clear that the institution of slavery was crumbling under the pressure of the military events themselves. And it should be emphasized in this part of the story, and I try to stress that, that the slaves themselves, the fugitives themselves, ultimately made an enormous contribution to the resolution of this problem that had existed from the beginning of the Republic. By the end of the war, more than 200,000 Black Americans were serving under arms in the Union Army, something that had been unthinkable in the early months of the war, when public opinion in the North would never have sustained the idea of handing out guns to Black people. But as the war went on and the manpower need became more and more imperative, and President Lincoln was under a lot of pressure from many, including Frederick Douglass and others, to allow Black people to fight for their own freedom, it became more and more thinkable, not only more thinkable, but an imperative for the successful prosecution of the war. So the war changed its character markedly, if gradually, and it became a war against slavery, so that anti-slavery and preservation of the Union became one and the same cause.
I always found it interesting, and I hope to find a book. I'm sure it exists, and I think you dive into this in some parts of your book, though your book's a much larger period, it covers a much larger period of time. But how the radical Republicans, and you mentioned Frederick Douglass too, who's his own entity really, but how in Congress the radical Republicans would use the committees that they controlled to direct the war in the direction that the war would go in towards making it a war about slavery.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, one of the ironies of this story, that I'm not sure there's a moral to this particular aspect, but it's, I think, important to note, is that if the war had been a short war, as so many expected, as an historian down at UVA, Gary Gallagher, who's written a good book called The Union War, makes this argument, if the war had been a short war, it's very likely that slavery would have survived it, because the Deep South would have been relatively unaffected by the military force, and the capitulation, it did not require any concession on the legality of slavery in the former states of the Union where it existed. Radical Republicans were therefore enthusiastic about the war and enthusiastic about prosecuting the war to the ultimate extent. And maybe you could even say, I don't know if enthusiastic is the right word, but willing to tolerate the pain and suffering and death and horror that the war entailed in order to achieve that goal. In retrospect, I think most of us would say the price was worth paying. A million dead for the emancipation of 4 million human beings whose ancestors had been enslaved and whose descendants would have been enslaved if the war had not taken the course it took. But again, I would suggest, and I guess I had this in my mind when I was writing, how many of us today would willingly send our sons and brothers and friends to their deaths for any moral cause? How many of us on the progressive side of the political spectrum would be willing to contemplate war of that scale and savagery as the method to achieve a better society? I'm not sure I would. So supporting the Civil War in retrospect is easy. Committing oneself to a war like that in prospect, maybe not so easy.
Andrew Delbanco has been our guest. Andrew Delbanco is the Alexander Hamilton Professor of American Studies at Columbia University, author of the book, The War Before the War, Fugitive Slaves and the Struggle for America's Soul from the Revolution to the Civil War. He has joined us for a conversation about the Fugitive Slave Act and everything around it, including why it matters today. Andrew Delbanco, I found that quite important and informative, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you, Mitch. I appreciate it very much.